Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, acknowledging the vital work of local public health departments to keep Californians safe during the pandemic. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. This week, we get local reaction to two landmark Supreme Court decisions. And a California writer talks about growing up amid Confederate imagery in his hometown. But first, a new report from UC Merced shows undocumented workers have been hit the hardest when it comes to job loss during the pandemic. As FM89's Madi Bolaños reports, this is especially true for women in non-essential jobs.
Before the pandemic hit, 59-year-old Maria had steady work cleaning houses in Merced and Winston. But COVID-19 changed everything. When the governor told everyone to shelter in place, the homeowners called me and told me not to go to their homes until this is all over.
That meant a huge loss in income. Maria made pretty good money, about $1,000 a week. But she says her clients were all older people who feared contracting the virus.
So I stayed at home after that because I'm also older and have diabetes, so getting another job will put me at risk too.
She's lived without documentation in California for the last 30 years, and she's asked us to use her first name only. And because of her status, job opportunities are also limited, she says. Doing agricultural work is not really an option.
I used to work in the fields, but I fainted twice due to the heat. It's hard for me to be out in the sun for long periods of time now.
Right now, she's staying at home where she shares a two-bedroom apartment with one of her daughters and four grandchildren. Her daughter receives welfare that covers the rent, but Maria is still responsible for paying the utilities.
Not working has affected me a lot because I have no money and I don't receive any government aid.
She tried applying for the California COVID-19 Relief Fund for undocumented workers, but she says she was never able to speak to anyone.
I spent the entire month of May calling and never getting through to anyone. And I imagine it's the same experience for others that have tried to use it.
Maria's story is not unique, says Edward Flores, a professor at UC Merced, who is researching recent job losses in the state. He says undocumented workers are getting hit the hardest.
In California, one out of every four pandemic-related job losses was among non-citizens.
And he says it's even higher, about one in three for women who are undocumented and doing non-essential work, especially in the service industry.
The service sector has been really slammed by the pandemic, and this is where a lot of immigrants and women concentrate, and so that's why it's affecting these groups most acutely.
Flores's research is based on the U.S. Census Bureau's current population survey for February and April of 2020, which shows trends in job losses. And when the economy does start to improve, Flores says undocumented women will be the last to recover.
The research shows that people of color and that women, those persons who are most marginalized in the workforce, are the first ones to be fired during a crisis and are the last ones to be hired during an economic recovery.
Recently, Maria did find one cleaning job. Right now, she's ironing a stack of clothes. She says it makes her nervous to return to work, but she also needs to pay her utilities bill.
This woman owns a ranch. I clean her house three times a week, and we make sure to keep a distance. It's not ideal, but it's what I have to do to earn some money.
And she's staying productive in other ways. Maria volunteers with an organization where she helps package masks for people working in the fields. She knows she can't do field work herself, but she wants to make sure those who do stay protected. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Madi Bolaños.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Yesterday, the United States Supreme Court handed down a long-awaited decision that prevents President Trump from ending the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, also known as DACA, which protects people brought to the United States as children from deportation and allows them to work. Hours after the decision was announced, I spoke with local DACA recipients, some of whom asked to be identified only by their first name. Joining in the discussion was Cecilia Castro, Education Policy Director for the Dolores Huerta Foundation, Hugo, a licensed vocational nurse who works in Fresno, and Karen, a student at Bakersfield College. She started the conversation by sharing her reaction to the decision.
At first, I was very anxious, very nervous, but I woke up to good news. Today is my birthday, so that was a good present to wake up to good news. I was really excited knowing that we'll still continue to have DACA. Also, new applicants can apply, and that's a plus as well. I do have a lot of friends and family members that didn't get the privilege to apply for DACA, right? So now with the great news, they can apply and have the benefits that DACA beholds for them. I'm really excited. This whole morning I was crying. We're just fighting for more because it's great news.
And Cecilia, what was your reaction?
I think for me it's bittersweet. And I say that because, of course, DACA has had a huge impact on my life. So I know without DACA, I definitely would not be here today. So I'm so happy, and I'm not just happy for myself, for the 800,000 undocumented young people and families that benefit from DACA. But I also know that DACA is not the solution to our broken immigration system, and we're going to have to continue advocating for comprehensive immigration reform. So it's a little bit of both, but I'm definitely happy.
And I definitely want to talk to you more about sort of the long-term solutions that are on the table. But first, I'd just like to get a quick reaction from Hugo to today's news.
Yeah, I was very happy to hear about the result of the court decision. I didn't feel like an extreme sense of joy because I right away went into this mode of thinking, okay, so it's been extended. So when is my permit due? I need to count days, figure out when as soon as I can reapply and make sure that I can secure, myself for the next 2 years. So it's kind of it has multiple facets to how I feel. It's like, yes, I'm happy. I get to, to continue to be here, but now I need to figure out what do I do next? Because again, it's not a permanent solution. It is just a Band-Aid. That's all it is.
So, Hugo, you were one of the, roughly 27,000 DACA recipients who work in the healthcare field and have been facing the possibility that you could lose your legal status to work in the middle of a pandemic. Can you share with us what it has been like to live with that anxiety? And tell us also just a little bit about the work that you do.
Yes, it's been very, very stressful. Ever since the pandemic just hit us, everything's been so busy. People are always worried. I do a combination of working with community care in a community health clinic, and I also go into people's home because I work for a home health agency, as well as I work for a registry. So I go into different buildings. So I'm like all over the place. So I'm always concerned because I have so much contact with so many different people in so many different places. That it's not only dangerous for myself, but it's dangerous for others. In fact, not only do I work in healthcare, the majority of my family works in healthcare. And for example, my mom, she's a certified nursing assistant, and she's one of those people who tested positive for coronavirus. She lives in Southern California, and she's been working in nursing homes where they've had huge outbreaks. So for a lot of us who are here, kind of like holding on to a tether, but we're still having to do this rough work. It's an added layer of stress.
Karen, you're a student at Bakersfield College. Can you speak also to the state of, or to what it must have been like for you over the past few years. You know, the Trump administration announced in 2017 its intent to end DACA. What has it been like to be in a state of limbo since then?
As a DACA beneficiary, I have been blessed to have a job and help all my family financially. I can attend college and apply for financial aid, you know, the California Dream Act application, without worrying that I might not get a job after I receive my degree. With the possibility, you know, of DACA being rescinded, I did have a lot of anxiety, and I would overthink my future when I should be focusing on completing my education and current financial survival. I felt like I couldn't just focus on one thing. I had to plan a B and C plan because I do have a son depending on me, and I am determined to achieve my goals and continue to contribute to this country because, you know, my home is here.
And your child is here.
Exactly.
What would you have done had the court decided the other way?
Honestly, get more informed. Because I know there is a lot of organizations out there that provide a lot of resources and help us out, us dreamers. I think I would have continued to still be working and provide for my son and myself and still help out my family. Also, if education would have not been the solution or something, I mean, I would still try to finish and pursue my career. Even if I wouldn't have a work permit, maybe down the road, something can change up and I will have my degree to start working. Just keep fighting, honestly, and advocating for my rights, for my child's rights, and for all the 800,000 dreamers out there that have DACA.
Cecilia, what have the past 3 years been like?
Yeah, I mean, just the feeling of uncertainty, it's not a good feeling to live with. I mean, ever since the 2016 elections, I mean, I think I had already come to a realization, you know, that this administration who perpetuates white supremacy was going to fight to overturn DACA. I think that was always in the back of my mind. And when that happened, it was just huge. I mean, for me, you know, DACA has been given me the opportunity to do so much. I mean, to work. I mean, now I work for an organization that does exactly what I once went through, which is finding your voice and finding your power and knowing and understanding the political system to understand that you do have a voice in this and you can change policy, you can change legislation. You can impact and improve your community and schools. And so, and now, especially with the pandemic, right? Of course, we're in this pandemic. We have folks that are fighting for Black lives. And in the midst of all of that, you know, we have this decision where you wake up every day thinking, is today the day where I'm going to find out if I'm going to lose my temporary legal residency? Right? And it was day after day after day. And then, you know, I think in the back of my mind, I always was just preparing for the worst, thinking that, you know, what is my plan going to look like? Do I have another plan? You know, and really, I think it was more of just preparing emotionally, because this has been such a, you know, a roller coaster of emotions, knowing, really not knowing, living with the not knowing in the limbo, right? And I've always had this kind of mentality that, you know, you keep going and you protest and you fight, and DACA has been years and years of young and old undocumented folks that have been fighting for, you know, through civil disobedience, through marches, pushing legislation. And really, you know, right now at the moment where we had this decision was really due to, you know, the protests and all the Black folks that have really risked their lives to do this. And I really do believe that, you know, they had a lot to do with the decision that came down for DACA.
Hugo, can you tell us a little bit of your backstory, how you came to the United States and what your experience has been like?
Yeah, so I got here to the U.S. when I was about 7 years old. My mom was fleeing from some, you know, domestic violence issues she was having, and she she just grabbed me and she brought us here. And next thing I know, I'm in a different place. I remember very little of when I was back in Mexico, and even very little from when I first came in. I know that when I first came in, they smuggled me in a car. I don't even remember how they did it. But just growing up in a new place where you don't speak the language, you have to learn a whole new language. You know, at home, they don't speak the language either. So you're trying to figure out how to communicate with them at home, because you learned a language, but you didn't really properly learn it when you were at home because you're only 7 years old. And then you're going to a school and you're trying to learn another language at the same time. It was very interesting and challenging. It's one of those things that I don't think about it too much anymore. But when I do, I'm like, wow, I can't believe that happened.
And Karen, what is your story?
I was brought to the United States when I was 4 years old, so I hardly remember my journey over here. I just know my mom sent me with an aunt. And when I start remembering or having flashbacks, it's when I was in preschool. I grew up in a small town called Lamont. I grew up there, and like Hugo said, you know, it was really hard for me knowing one language and then trying to learn another one at a different environment, you know, and at a new place, at school, trying to help out your parents translate with teachers and principals and other people. So I hardly remember anything of my motherland, Mexico. But my experience as a DACA or undocumented person, it was really, really tough. I did go through some type of discrimination. My skin is brown, so they would also call me ugly names because I didn't speak English, right? And then my skin color would be different from others. So that was one thing I did experience growing up. But as I grew older, I felt like it doesn't really matter where you're from, what color you are, what languages you speak, how your hair looks. We're all the same. We're humans. We should treat each other with respect and love each other and help each other out.
And Cecilia, how about you?
So I came to the U.S. with my family when I was about 6 years old. And I, you know, a lot of what has been mentioned resonates a lot with me, because I know that we have had similar experiences where I was also brought to the U.S. in a car and don't really remember how. And so my family, of course, moved here for a better life. My parents, you know, have always had to work two jobs, had to really provide for our family, you know, themselves experiencing discrimination, not knowing the language. But really, my family, you know, really, really valued education. And I think that's why I'm such a strong advocate and now work in the field of education policy, because I do feel that they really, you know, instilled that value in me and gave me that opportunity. And coming to the U.S., you know, really gave me that opportunity to really get a quality education. And for me growing up, I think it was before the time where I think I really knew and my voice to say, like, I am undocumented. And so for a lot of the time, I mean, throughout high school, even my beginning years of college, I think, you know, I didn't want to tell anybody that I was undocumented. I, you know, just kept it to myself. I, you know, had been privileged and lucky enough, and my parents worked hard enough for me to attend the UC system. But then even being there, feeling like you don't belong, where, you know, you are experiencing these challenges and don't really have anybody to tell, right? At that time, you know, there wasn't the Dream Act. And so I think going to college and really finding other undocumented students in this movement that had already been created, right? Because DACA had been a year, like, 10 plus years of a movement before it even became the executive order, right? And then finding, you know, that group of folks that really helped me find my voice in being able to say that I was undocumented and being able to advocate for DACA and being able to advocate for undocumented students. So I really think that, you know, DACA has really shaped who I want to be and who I've become. And now, you know, being able to educate other young people and other folks in our communities about not having this fear, right? Not letting your undocumented status make you, you know, have to be your own identity, that you have many, many other identities. So it's definitely been a challenge, but I think it's been an experience of growth for me, definitely.
Hugo, I believe it was earlier in the conversation that you described DACA as a Band-Aid. What do you want to see, and how optimistic are you that Congress could provide eventually or get to a long-term permanent solution?
Well, I mean, ideally, I would hope for a path to citizenship. I mean, I've been in California my entire life. I'm 32 years old. I came here when I was 7. I don't remember any other country. I don't remember any other state. I've been in California my whole life. I don't live California. I've traveled outside of California a handful of times, and that's it. So, I mean, I don't, and even if DACA were to end, I don't plan on going anywhere because this is my home. You know, if they deport me, well, they deport me, but I'm not living of my own, you know, free will. So ideally, I'd like to see a path to citizenship. I mean, everybody who benefits from DACA, we had to prove that we are not doing anything illegal, that we are not criminals, that we are contributing to the system. So, I mean, just on that basis, I would imagine that would be a huge incentive for lawmakers to help pass something that's going to allow us to do that. So I that's what I would like to see. Whether or not they're going to do it, that's a whole nother story. I'm hopeful, but I'm also realistic. I'm always trying to think of a backup plan. What am I going to do if it doesn't work out? But as it stands with the current Congress we have, I don't really see it happening. That might change with the election, and I'm knocking on wood and, you know, donating money and doing whatever I can to, you know, to help, you know, change the you know, who Congress is right now and who the president is right now, so that can happen. Because as it stands, I doubt it would happen.
Cecilia, I would imagine you agree.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, all of us, I don't want to speak for every DACA recipient, but I know that we all understand that this is not a solution, that we definitely have a broken immigration system, and that pathway to citizenship is really what we all need, and not necessarily just for DACA recipients, right? But what about the families? You know, there are families that are mixed status families. You know, what about our parents? Right, my parents have been here for years and have not been able to fix their legal status. I mean, we're really advocating for all those families, for all our families, for those that may be, you know, working in the healthcare system, for those that are working in the nonprofit system, for those that are essential workers. We can't just have those model citizens just be the ones that receive this kind of benefit, right, that it really needs to be a comprehensive immigration reform and plan that benefits the 11 million undocumented people that are in this country.
I think such an important point that Cecilia is making, because as I mentioned earlier, my mom's a nursing assistant. She's not documented. She works in nursing facilities taking care of, you know, people's parents. And, you know, she's exposing herself. She became infected with COVID-19, but she's still out there doing that job. And she's such a caring person and so good at it. And she has no status, none whatsoever. So I think that point that Cecilia is making is so important, that we have so many different kinds of people that you know, that would benefit from something more comprehensive that's going to apply to them as well.
Yes, I agree with both of them. Like I said, our parents, honestly, our parents, our ancestors were the first dreamers, trying to like fight for this, for a comprehensive reform immigration, so we can like fix the system. It's not fair that, because we do have a lot of farm workers. We live in California. It's full of agriculture, right? There's farm workers that are feeding us, and they don't have any status or any protection whatsoever, right? The most vulnerable people out there. And like my parents are agriculture workers, and throughout this whole pandemic situation, they told them, you guys are going to do more hours, and that's it. They didn't tell them, like, hey, you know, you guys take some time off, because I am aware that many employers came out positive, and they didn't do anything. They kept running the machines, but I also understand them in a way, because we are feeding mostly the whole nation, right? So I truly agree with both Cecilia and Hugo for your responses. Yes, I truly agree.
Well, I thank you all for being with us and for sharing your stories. And I wish you all the best in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Although businesses are reopening throughout the San Joaquin Valley, new cases of COVID-19 are still rising. Here to put this all into context is FM89's health reporter, Carrie Klein. Carrie, welcome.
Hi, thanks, Kathleen.
So what are case numbers looking like in the Valley this week?
They're not looking very good. They rose in every county this week, and in many counties, these new cases are accelerating rather than slowing down. When we did this update last week, around 20 people had died of COVID in the previous week, and this week it's close to 30, depending on exactly which day you get the numbers from. Generally, health officers seem to be very concerned. None that I've heard from this week are you know, they're not talking about rolling back reopening of businesses or anything like that, but they do keep hammering home social distance and wear face coverings. A few county highlights from around our coverage area. In Fresno County, health officials are asking for blood and plasma donations from those who have survived the disease. Kern County has been added to the state watch list. Fresno, Tulare, and Kings had previously been on this list, but now Kern County is there as well for extra monitoring from the state, primarily because of rising cases at nursing homes and correctional facilities. Speaking of correctional facilities, in Kings County, still more than half of all cases are in state-run prisons, three prisons there. In Tulare County, a Tulare Works district office in Visalia, which helps people with CalFresh and Medi-Cal benefits, that's been closed temporarily because one employee there tested positive earlier this week. There was also an outbreak at an almond processing facility in Merced County. There were 8 cases there. And in Madera County and Mariposa, the numbers are still quite low, but there have been new cases this week, and daily cases are increasing.
How much of that rise in cases could be due to increased testing?
That's a good question. People ask that a lot, but I think only some of it, because here, and at least in the bigger counties in our area, hospitalizations and ICU admissions due to COVID are increasing. So that suggests that the disease really does continue to take a bigger toll on the population.
Okay. So last week you brought us a report on a Valley fever outbreak at Avenal State Prison 10 years ago. What's happening with the COVID outbreak right now?
So as of right now, there are 920 cumulative cases among the incarcerated population and 64 cases among staff. That's still, that makes it the second highest total among all state-run prisons. But fortunately, there have been no deaths, and hundreds of those have recovered already.
So how are prison officials trying to rein this in?
Well, the State Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, known as CDCR, has filled its website with tons of information, policies, procedures, timelines. CDCR representatives declined an interview request from me for this, but they did provide a lot of information by email. And so they said that they're doing things like daily temperature checks for staff at Avenal, mandatory protective equipment like masks, other face coverings. There's mandatory staff testing at Avenal, but also a few other institutions, though it's unclear exactly how often that testing has to happen. CDCR also says it's doing widespread testing of the incarcerated population, though it's still not clear if that means systematically testing everyone and how often those tests happen. CDCR says they've also established a number of different housing facilities at Avenal so that they have different places to put those who test positive and those who test negative and others who are kind of awaiting their test results.
But I understand you spoke with some prison reform advocates who dispute some of what the Department of Corrections is saying.
Yeah, I spoke with two organizers with an organization called FUEL. It's a group that advocates to end life sentences without parole. The two women were Satina Green and Michelle Tran. And Tran herself, actually, her husband has been incarcerated at Avenal for 4 years. Their main concerns are that these cases were preventable. And now that the disease has entered many state prisons, that CDCR is not doing enough to isolate the disease and keep other people from being infected. They also talk regularly with, you know, folks who are inside the prison who also claim that CDCR's social distancing of the incarcerated is not adequate, especially in kind of these dorm style housing. With lots of beds in one room. They claim that staff are not following the PPE policies and that prison officials are not enforcing those policies well enough. A number of other claims as well. I tried to confirm or refute these with CDCR, but they wouldn't specifically address these questions.
Okay. So as you said earlier, cases coming out of Avenal and to other correctional facilities actually outpace those among the community in Kings County. Are county health officials concerned, and are they getting involved at all?
Yeah, I spoke with Ed Hill. He's the director of the Kings County Public Health Department. He is concerned, particularly about the strain on the healthcare system when incarcerated people become too sick for CDCR facilities and have to be hospitalized. He also said that last month, the county issued 6 health orders to the prison. So things like ordering employee incarcerated testing, ordering isolating infectious people, things like that. And in response, the CDCR said the county has no jurisdiction over a state prison. And so it doesn't mean that they're not taking those precautions into account, but it does mean that the county has had to take more of a back burner role in what's happening at the prison.
Wow, so interesting. Carrie, thank you so much. I look forward to following up more with you as this develops.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. The Supreme Court delivered another landmark decision on Monday that protects gay, lesbian, and transgender employees from workplace discrimination. To learn more about the fight for LGBTQ job protections, I spoke with Robin McGeehee. She organized the Meet in the Middle gay marriage rally in 2009 and founded the nonprofit Get Equal. She also teaches communication at the College of the Sequoias in Visalia.
What went through your mind when you first heard the decision?
Honestly, I was in shock. I mean, you know, it feels like we've been in a perpetual bad news cycle for almost 4 years for me in reference to the election of Trump. But then, you know, with everything that's been going on in the country with COVID-19 and what we've watched in reference to Black Lives Matter and just all of the social unrest that is justified, but also sadly taking place in our country. I have to be honest and say that, you know, I kind of lost hope that we are a nation of good people and that we were going to, you know, follow the saying of Martin Luther King and, you know, that arc of justice is really going to be something that we'll reach one day. And so when that Supreme Court ruling was announced, it was shock first and then elated because, in my opinion, if you look at the wind of marriage equality, it really means nothing if you can't put your spouse's photo on your desk. The reality is that employment protection provides so much for people in reference to, you know, just equal protection under the law.
Absolutely. And maybe you could expand a little bit more on this idea around how central the fight for workplace protection has been to the larger movement.
Yeah. I mean, so if you look at, there's a gentleman by the name of Frank Kameny, and, you know, recently passed away within the last decade. But he was one of the first noted records of someone who was found out to be gay and he was fired from his job. And he from that moment on became a lifelong activist trying to fight for equality in reference to LGBT workplace discrimination. He came up with the slogan, gay is good, and they did lots of different demonstrations outside the Capitol and in all around DC. And to think that, you know, that was something that was happening, you know, in the 60s. And, you know, well before that, if you look at just our trajectory as a nation, and know that here we are in 2020, and this is even number one up for debate, but also that the protections people are using, you know, religious freedom to argue that their right of not wanting to employ a queer person trumps, no pun intended, the rights of a person who wants to live their life openly and honestly. And so, in reality, this particular court decision could have far-reaching implications in reference to health benefits, in housing. There's so many different things that this is going to influence. And you know, I'm grateful for the plaintiffs that actually, you know, took the role of pushing it to this position, and, you know, the legal advisors and lawyers that actually won. And sadly, two of the plaintiffs didn't even, you know, live to see the results of their, you know, fight for justice.
So this moment comes as we also remember the 49 who were killed in the Pulse nightclub shooting 4 years ago, which is such a sobering reminder that while this was a big step forward for the LGBTQ community, it's far from the end. So I'm wondering if you could speak to what comes next.
So the most immediate thing is this election that's happening in November, and making sure that we protect this win at the Supreme Court, because if we lose seats, and, you know, if Trump is reelected, he is definitely going to have Supreme Court nominees and placements within, you know, his next 4 years if he's reelected. And, you know, potentially losing, quote unquote, liberal judges, our justice-seeking judges that are on the Supreme Court, there's a huge risk if we don't do the work and elect someone who's going to ensure that there is a equality and justice for all mentality going on to the Supreme Court. Because, you know, this is a landmark case, but right after that, we are going to see cases where religious freedoms are going to be argued again in front of the Supreme Court. And, you know, those decisions could essentially begin to negate some of the wins that we just won this week. And, you know, the reality for this particular case, or this win, only really protects people that work for companies that have 16 or more employees. If you work for a small business with 15 or fewer employees, you can still be fired, because it's not an overarching particular piece of the stance, is not overarching. And so there's still work that has to be done, not only within the Supreme Court, but work still has to be done within the federal government and within the state legislature to make sure that we are actually ensuring everyone's right to live openly and honestly as a queer person.
So you're a professor of communications at College of Sequoias, and you were formerly the advisor of the Pride Club. I know it's summer, but I'm wondering anything you're hearing from students or other young people or other young activists that you're connected with.
Absolutely, yes. So, you know, part of what this does is it creates validation, and there's a sense of dignity that comes with knowing that you have the ability to be open in the workplace. You know, I personally know students that have been fired because their boss found out that they were queer, and no fault of their own, not self-disclosing it, but it just happened in, you know, either someone disclosing it for them or outing them, or, you know, just simply based on appearance, they're not conforming to what the gender norms would be, quote unquote, for that particular place of employment. And so part of what the youth movement, in my opinion, is feeling is that ownership of, you know, number one, we want to be honest about who we are. We are not going to sit back and let people bully us and tell us that we can't be honest about who we are. And they also have seen wins, like, you know, winning marriage equality, winning the right to serve in the military. And so this win only feels natural, and it probably feels fitting. But you know, as a person that grew up very closeted in the south of Mississippi, I know that the work can't stop. I think that's also what you see with LGBT activists that are getting involved in the Black Lives Matter movement. They're seeking a fuller, more inclusive equality fight. And it's not just about queer rights. It's about being a more just society. And I see the excitement in those youth that are feeling those wins. But that means that we've got to get to the polls in November. We have to continue to organize and make sure that justices are appointed that are going to actually back up and support the rights of, you know, everyone, not just the select few. And for me, it's a very promising time if we can just stay the course and hold accountable people like Trump and those who try to blatantly discriminate.
As somebody who has dedicated so much of your life to activism, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you to weigh in a little bit more about the protests that we're seeing in the U.S. and around the world. What advice do you have for the organizers and the activists that are pushing for police reform in terms of how to capitalize on the momentum of this moment?
That's a great question. And, you know, the major thing is you have to be putting strategy into every move. And so, number one, not letting up, you know. So for example, I've been so happy to see that there is a consistency in reference to the responses that are happening. So it's not just a flash in the pan where you see a movement and there's action. You know, if you look at the Women's March, you know, it was something that there was lots of activity and lots of protests that came after Trump was elected, but the steam kind of, you know, fell short, and now you do a yearly march. And the problem is that systemic change has to have a continual push against it, or push for it, so you can break those society barriers. And so the, you know, one bit of advice that I would give is, number one, don't stop pushing, but also to remind yourself that it is a marathon and it's not a sprint. And so people do, as activists, get burned out, and it's hard to, you know, keep that momentum, especially when you feel like you can have action, things will happen, and then you'll see, you know, what happened in Atlanta where the young man was killed just for sleeping in the drive-thru, and, you know, he was shot in the back and he's running away. I mean, these cases of injustice are happening, and we have to, number one, continue to hold it accountable and be very visible with that fight. But you've got to be strategic and begin to say, these are the types of changes that we want, and we know that these things can happen. So I was very reassured last week when I saw a lot of the Black Lives Matter activists coming out in DC and saying, you know, look, we do have a plan of the things that we would like to see as reform. And the moment that you can point to that and say, this is what we want, and not let up until you get it, then you hold the power. The moment that you're just protesting without direction, then they hold the power, because then they can say, you know, well, you're just, you know, frustrated and a liberal activist. And that's sometimes what happened in our movement. You know, we would march, have a march on Washington, and we didn't have a bill specifically to get behind until the Equal Rights Bill started to be pushed. And so you have to have some type of joint effort that is strategic, and you have to have that continual push that you don't give up on.
Well, Robin McGeehee, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Conversations are taking place all over the country about the removal of Confederate statues and names, even in the military, where 10 Army bases are named after Confederate officers. Author Nicholas Bilardis recently wrote about growing up in Bakersfield in the 1970s and 80s and going to a high school steeped in Confederate symbolism. News director Alice Daniel spoke with him about his essay, which is published in the online magazine Boom California.
Nicholas Bilardis, welcome to Valley Edition. I'd like to start by asking you to read the section of your essay called A White Mythology.
Thank you for having me. I'm just going to jump right in. A White Mythology. Confederate and Civil War imagery surround me. It's 1982. I'm 14, a freshman at South High School, home of the rebels, the blue and gray, the Merrimack yearbook, Johnny and Jody Yell leaders in military-style gray uniforms and Confederate hats. Our mascot is a cartoon Confederate soldier. I don't understand what I'm seeing. I don't understand racism, slavery, war, who fought what or when and for what cause. I'm so caught up in our school spirit, I pin a tiny Confederate flag to a Confederate soldier hat my Mexican-American dad brings home from a swap meet. He thinks it's cool. I think this is what high school is all about. Rebel soldiers, like Star Wars, like The Empire Strikes Back. I don't realize a cartoon mascot is a symbol for retaining an economic system that allows for the horrific right to own slaves. I somehow think I'm one of the good guys. Street names around South High are all Civil War inspired. Sumter, Merrimack, Monitor, Rebel, Raider, Evelyn. Evelyn might be Evelyn Magruder Desjarnet, a white 19th century writer. She taught slave kids on a Virginia plantation. She culturally appropriated them by writing stories in slave dialect. Her husband was a captain for the Confederate Army, a farmer who owned slaves. Take a turn down white supremacist lane onto Monitor Street and you'll reach Plantation Avenue. An elementary school by the same name still stands there. So do the street names.
And you added the word supremacist to the essay. It's just called White Lane, correct?
Correct. You know, when you look at a map of that area, you can see all those street names and it's really shocking. And you see White Lane. And White Lane, I don't necessarily think has anything to do with the Confederate names, but it's strange when you look at a map, it just jumps out at you.
And you end with the line that the school names and street names are still there, but what if anything has changed since then?
Well, really nothing's changed since then. You know, this area was born out of the 1950s in city planning, and it's very sympathetic to this notion of Southern pride and Confederate imagery, a Confederate white mythology built into the fabric of a community. And since then, the street names are all still there. Plantation Elementary is still there. South High is still there. But the only thing that's really changed that I've seen is not only was the Confederate flag banned from South High's campus in 1968, but the mascot itself, the only thing that I've found that's changed is now it wears a baseball cap. But the same artwork is still there.
Well, in another section, you write that Black and brown kids lose their self-identity in this imagery. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
You know, I think that when communities aren't allowed to be themselves, then I think when you have something like this white superiority complex, it so permeates the culture they live in, the community they live in, it completely indoctrinates so many students, and this is in the thousands of students, Black and brown, who've gone to South High, who've gone to Plantation Elementary School. And so I feel like there's a part of people that gets taken away from them, from that experience.
And you write about that experience from a personal perspective too. You're 14, the mascot is a cartoon Confederate soldier. And meanwhile, your dad, who is Mexican American, is giving you a Confederate hat to wear. And we learn as we read in the rest of the essay, he's also kind of preaching whiteness, telling you you're white. Talk a little bit about him and how your relationship with him changed over the years.
Well, you know, my dad, you know, just like South High and Plantation and all those street names popping up in the 1950s, and my dad was a teenager in the 1950s in San Jose, California, and he lived at a time when this romanticization was happening in America of Southern pride, which also happened in California. It happened in places like San Jose, California, too, which we know nowadays, like Bakersfield, is a place that has a huge number of Latinos and Blacks. And so, but during that time in the 1950s, you know, my dad had odds stacked against him to assimilate, this idea of total and complete assimilation. So, you know, I think that my dad was kind of a victim of that, but, and I obviously don't like how that turned out with my dad, because I think once he joined the San Jose State Police Academy as one of the only Latinos there, I think that, well, let's look back to the 1960s now, early 60s, how can he not be indoctrinated into this sort of, you know, white mythology. How can he not be assimilated? Now, later on in life, you know, part of the good story about this is, you know, later on in life, my dad was, he didn't have those same racist views. I was really glad that he didn't. But once again, you know, these are all really complex issues. And I think we as people of the Central Valley have to admit to ourselves how really complex our families are. The issues of racism and race are in our own families. And so, you know, I think we have these long story arcs of our own, and they just get really complex.
Well, I was wondering how his proximity to whiteness and telling you you're white informed your relationship with African Americans as a kid.
You know, it's really sad in how it informed my relationship, because on one hand, I had my dad saying, you know, using racial epithets that, you know, weren't good to use, obviously, and saying things like, you need to be afraid of people of color. Now, come on, I mean, growing up in a home that's dual ethnic, my dad is a person of color with really, really dark brown skin, and he's telling me to be afraid of people of color. So that, you know, that informed me in a way that made me afraid. But at the same time, you know, you grow up, you learn things for your own. You learn that you can have black and brown friends and not have to be afraid of people, that kids sometimes are smarter than the adults around them and can figure things out and say, yeah, you know, my dad's just kind of wrong about these things. And of course, you know, it also took me years to reeducate myself, because that wasn't going to come from the home. It was going to come from myself educating myself and going to college and becoming a history major like I did, and going to graduate school in history and just learning on my own that I don't have to be what my father tried to make me to be.
And monuments are coming down all over the country. Names are being changed. Is this a conversation you're hoping to start in Bakersfield with this essay?
Well, it's time for change, don't you think? I mean, that's it's happening all over California, this discussion of monuments. And in Bakersfield, you know, there's a couple of plaques that are Confederate monuments. But what's staring people in the face in that community is what I bring up in the essay, is you have these schools that have these names like Plantation, that, and you have these Confederate named street signs. You know, those kinds of things need to be part of the conversation too. You know, why not name the school after a black doctor or a black teacher, a Latina labor leader? Build a necessary and new kind of community pride. And because, like I said earlier, literally thousands and thousands of kids are going to these schools, and they are just learning to accept sort of like this Gone with the Wind image of Plantation. When we know, if we as Americans are looking at our history, that is a candy-coated image. The real image is that Plantation's built on a slave economy. And slaves were oh my goodness, were emancipated. And to have that imagery now, in 2020, it's just not acceptable. So, you know, it's time for change.
Well, Nicholas Bilardis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Laura Satsui, Carrie Klein, and Madi Bolaños. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, acknowledging the vital work of local public health departments to keep Californians safe during the pandemic. On the web at chcf.org.